This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com. Most scientists now believe that there are unobservable entities in the world. These entities can't be seen, touched, smelt, or felt. In that sense, they're not like ordinary objects, tables or tomatoes or television sets. But, at least according to scientific realists, they're just as real as tables or tomatoes or television sets. David Papineau is a tangible professor of King's College London.
David Papineau, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
I'm very pleased to be here, Nigel.
We're focusing on scientific realism. Could you just explain what scientific realism is and perhaps say what the issue is?
Scientific realism is the view that the world as described by scientific theories really exists and we know about that world. And in particular, it's concerned with the world of unobservables, the world of electrons and atoms, molecules, viruses, radio waves and so on, things that we can't see. So it's a contentious issue whether we really do know them to exist or not. In the area of philosophy of science, skepticism is a serious option. The view that while there no doubt is an unobservable world, we have no way of finding out about it. If you compare that with the philosophy, epistemology of the everyday medium-sized physical object world, there we talk about skepticism in philosophy 101 in the classroom. But it's just an exercise. How can you refute the skeptic? Nobody really thinks that we don't know about tables and chairs and everyday objects. But in philosophy of science, quite a lot of serious people think we don't know about the unobservable world and that scientific theories are just kind of convenient, useful myths but aren't reporting on reality.
So the skeptic says that unobservable things, which scientists talk about, are actually convenient myths, convenient fictions, whereas the realist says these things actually exist.
Exactly. And this issue has a very interesting history. I mean, at the start of the scientific revolution, Descartes, Boyle, running up to Newton, the scientists were serious realists about the observable world. I mean, they were very optimistic. In fact, it was defining characteristic of the scientific revolution that its adherents were mechanical philosophers. They thought the whole world was a machine. The observable things that we saw were composed of lots of small little bits, and it was the behavior of the bits in interaction that explained what we observed. And they set out to try and figure out what these bits were. I mean, they were materialists. They thought the whole world was made of complicated arrangements of matter. And the trouble was they didn't get very far in the 17th century. I mean, they found out quite a lot of interesting things, like the air exerts pressure, and if you go up a mountain, the pressure reduces. But when they tried to figure out what the mechanism responsible for that was, well, I mean, was the air made of little kind of springs like you get inside a biro, or is the air some kind of elastic solid that we can walk through? And they didn't have any clue about how to answer that. And Newton figured out that gravity obeyed the inverse square law, but when the question came, exactly why do bodies move in this way, no mechanistic explanation could be derived. And Newton himself famously said, hypotheses no non fingo, I feign no hypotheses, by which he meant he thought it wasn't the proper business of science to speculate about all these unobservable mechanisms, and speculate was what he thought it would have to be. And if you think about it, perfect natural point of view, how could we possibly figure out that tables or bits of wood are made of all these? I mean, it's completely flabbergasting that we should now take ourselves to know such things. And the view, after a best part of a century of trying, was that the scientists all gave up and they regarded any such theorizing as perhaps fruitful, but certainly not seriously to believe speculation. And so it went until well into the 19th century.
So are you saying that skepticism arose principally through the failures of science?
Absolutely. And as I've just explained, it seems to me a perfectly natural position to adopt, especially in the absence of any convincing serious scientific theories of the relevant kind, theories of unobservables.
What happened then in the 19th century to change all this?
Well, what happened in the 19th century is for the first time, some serious, testable theories of the unobservable microscopic mechanisms responsible for what we observe became available. In particular, the atomic theory of matter, which started being developed when people got clear about chemistry and the difference between elements and compounds and mixtures and laws of constant combination by mass and volume. And if you think about that, natural explanation is that bits of matter are made of little particles that combine in certain simple whole number of volumes. And then that combined with the kinetic theory of gases and the kinetic theory of heat. And by the end of the 19th century, there was an overwhelming amount of evidence in favor of the atomic theory. The philosophers and the philosophical scientists were still persuaded by Newton that this couldn't be serious, but it became so manifestly serious that slowly the scientists all joined up, and by the early 20th century, they'd all become realists. They thought we could, because it manifestly was possible, we could find out about the unobservable world. But of course, a few philosophers remained unpersuaded.
Essentially what these scientists are doing is hypothesizing about causes on the basis of visible effects.
Exactly. And that leaves a couple of openings for philosophers who aren't convinced of scientific realism to remain skeptics. Now, interestingly, I mean, they don't call themselves skeptics nowadays. There's a number of terms. They're instrumentalists or empiricists or constructive empiricists. In truth, all these people who have doubts about scientific knowledge of the unobservable world are just skeptics, adding perhaps a little bit about how the theories are useful instruments for making predictions or suggesting new research and so on. But basically, they think, with the 18th and early 19th century scientists, that knowledge of the unobservable world is not possible.
So why exactly do they think that?
Well, there's two powerful and pretty influential arguments against scientific realism. One is the argument from the underdetermination of theory by evidence. The thought here is that given any set of observable phenomena, there'll always be a number of alternative explanations for those phenomena. So imagine the phenomena of light, the initial light, angle of reflection equals angle of refraction, principles of refraction, Snell's law. All those things can be explained either by a wave theory of light or, given a little bit of work, by the particle theory of light. And so now you've got two different explanations, two different possible causes for the same observable phenomena, how you just decide between them. So that's the argument from the underdetermination of theory by evidence. The other argument is called the pessimistic meta-induction from past falsity. Sorry, that sounds a bit of a mouthful, but it's easy enough. It's the argument that says if you look at past scientific theories, they all turn out to be wrong, so our theories are probably wrong too. You can see it's pessimistic, and it's a meta-induction because it's inducing from the past failures of science to present failures.
Okay, let's take those one at a time. The underdetermination of a theory by the data. Well, that sounds quite plausible. You made a good case for it with the example of light. There are two alternative explanations, both of which fit the observable facts and the theories we have around those.
Good. But it's not as powerful an argument as it looks at first sight. Those two theories, the wave theory, particle theory, they're both on the cards, given the initial data I described. The initial data can be explained equally well by both those theories. But in most cases, in particular that case, it's possible to figure out some prediction that's made by one of the theories and not by the other, and then test it. That's called a crucial experiment. And in that case, well, the wave theory predicts that you'll observe certain interference phenomena in certain situations, and the particle theory doesn't have any natural explanation of that. And when we try it, we find interference patterns. Particle theory is out, and the wave theory wins. Now, that doesn't fully settle the underdetermination by evidence argument, because one can always come up with some other theory that will now, alongside the wave one, explain all the phenomena, including the interference phenomena. Here's a couple of silly theories. One is that there isn't any unobservable world, there's just the observable world, and it just so happens that in certain situations we observe interference phenomena. So that's a kind of atheistic theory of the data. There's nothing behind the observable world. Here's another theory. There's lots of little green men running around, much too small to see, and they're arranging everything in just such a way as to make the wave theory look right. Now, those are both coherent, consistent theories. They explain the data. But, of course, nobody takes them at all seriously. And, in effect, to argue from those kind of theories is just to say that it's never possible to infer anything that goes beyond the evidence. And that, in other contexts, is not a principle that's adopted and shouldn't be adopted in science. So the truth is that given any two serious theories, you can normally decide between them by doing some more experiments. And then you'll be left with some crackpot theories, but I don't think anybody should seriously think the crackpot theories undermine our knowledge of, say, the atomic theory of matter or the wave theory of light, for that matter.
So what you're saying is that usually when there are two competing theories running side by side, it's not that both are in a sense true or anything like that. There is a right answer, it's just we haven't quite worked out how to find out the crucial experiment which will decide it. And when we do that, science moves on, we get rid of one of the theories. Trouble is that then we've got this pattern of rejecting theories over and over again. Each theory is set up to be knocked down.
No, well, that's the other argument. That's the pessimistic meta-induction from past falsity. And you can see in a rather interesting way, they aren't kind of complementary arguments. And interestingly, sceptics about scientific knowledge tend to run either one or the other. I mean, you can see why the underdetermination argument says there are too many good theories, whereas the pessimistic meta-induction argument says there's too few good theories. In fact, there aren't any. So maybe we should turn to the second argument. That's a very serious argument, if in truth past theories all turn out to be false, then it would be foolish to feel that somehow, if our theories are the same, those must be true. So realists have a number of options. One thing they might do is say, look, the past theories aren't just outright false. They were wrong on a few details, but basically they had a lot of truth, and they were approximately true. Actually, the wave theory of matter isn't exactly right because now with quantum theory we know that light moves in wave-like particles, photons. But still, the fact that light obeys equations of wave motion and displacement, that was all okay. So the theory was approximately true.
If we're talking about what's approximately true, is that good enough for realism to say what really is there if we're just approximating?
Well, realism, schmealism. No, sure. I mean, if realism was supposed to be the current scientific theories we know to be exactly true, that realism is no good. But we have a position that says our current scientific theories no doubt have an awful lot of truth in it, and we have every entitlement to be confident about that. Well, maybe it's not the realism that you might have hoped for in the first place, but given the evidence of past scientific theories, it looks like the right position to adopt.
But it's not a historical relativism about scientific truth, is it?
No, just the opposite. That's a position you'd adopt if you were moved by the pessimistic meta-induction. You'd think that each time's theories was believed by the people of the time, but from a more objective, timeless point of view, you could see that all these theories had no real authority. They were all out of tune with what reality was like. So people thought they were right, but they aren't. I mean, that's the relativist point of view. The point of view of the realist who resists the pessimistic meta-induction is that, no, all these theories have some good truth in them, not every detail of the theory, but lots of truth, and that builds up, and we should trust what the scientists say to that extent.
Does that then mean that there can't be scientific revolutions where the whole way of doing science is radically transformed?
Well, if you bought the story about approximate truth, that would mean there were no scientific revolutions. I mean, new theories built on the old ones. But I haven't yet given you convincing reason to suppose that. And if you look at the history of science, there are plenty of cases which don't seem to fit the approximate truth story. I mean, if you think of classical mechanics, Newton being replaced by Einstein, well, there's some ways of counting Newton that what it says about objects at low velocity is approximately true. What it says about objects moving at velocities close to the speed of light is wildly wrong. And so I think there the realist probably has to adopt a different strategy. And I think what a realist should say is that that original pessimistic meta-induction is just too crude, even if we put to one side the issues of approximate truth. Look, there's some areas in which it seems that new theories do radically overthrow old ones. I mean, general theories of space-time, cosmology, we do get these kind of revolutions, and I think the moral is that we should take current cosmological theories with a pinch of salt. I mean, we have current general relativity, Big Bang, but it's quite possible in 50 years' time we'll think reality has 13 dimensions and what we observe is just a low-energy four-dimensional projection of it, and it will seem to us that what we currently believe is all wrong. But I don't think that one should infer from that that the atomic theory of matter is all wrong. There's cases and cases. There's some areas of science. I mentioned general cosmology, but I can think of psychology, environmental science, where there's all these flip-flops all the time. And there's other areas of science, chemistry, parts of engineering, where people build steadily on the past theories. And I think the moral is obvious. There's some areas of science where we can have a high degree of credence in the theories, and other areas of science where we ought to be pretty sceptical.
So you're saying that we should be a sceptic about some areas of science and a realist about others?
Absolutely, and if you think that I'm kind of giving up on what I promised you earlier, scientific realism, well, that's too bad, because it seems to me the position I've outlined is obviously the sensible one. I mean, if you think about the question in the first place, should we be realists about science, about everything put forward by people who claim the authority of scientists? Well, why should we? I mean, we should be realists about good theories, and we should be sceptical about dodgy ones.
The difficulty, of course, is finding out which are good and which are dodgy.
Good. And so one thing I've pointed to is past track record in different areas of science. So cosmology doesn't have that great a track record. Post-1800 chemistry has a terrific track record. But one might try and back that up by looking at something else, which is maybe the reason some areas have a good track record and other ones don't, is that some areas have plenty of evidence and other areas are working with very thin evidence. I mean, here's another example. Paleoanthropology, the history of the evolution of the hominids lineage over the past 5 million years. People keep on changing their minds and Australopithecus and that was all wrong and we've got five new species. And why? It's because they're struggling with a few bits of tooth and bone to figure out a lot of detailed stuff from 5 million years ago. So it's not surprising that they're guessing. Whereas I referred earlier to the wealth of evidence that developed in 19th century atomic chemistry, kinetic theory. If you go and look at all that evidence, it would be very, very difficult not to be completely convinced of the atomic theory. So this difference in track record, I think, reflects another thing which gives us independent reason to be more serious about some theories than others, that some theories have a lot more evidence in their favour than other ones.
The example you just gave was actually a historical one. I mean, what happened in the past? It seems to me there are some parallels there. Look, if we're doing history, you could say there's just not enough evidence to decide between competing theories. But most people are going to say, well, surely something really did happen nevertheless.
Good. So that takes us back to the beginning in a way. I've been articulating the strengths and weaknesses of scientific realism, by which I mean not just the view that there is an independent reality, but that plus the view that we can know about it. The view that there is an independent reality and we can't know about it, that's scepticism. And so, yes, of course, there's a fact of the matter about what happened in the past, including what happened in the paleoanthropological past, but the interesting issue here, which is one we've been debating, is can we find out about it?
Just to round this up then, it sounds to me as if what you're saying is that the history of science is actually the history of getting closer to the truth.
Well, I did qualify that by saying in some areas it's not obvious that's so, but in other areas, yes, it is. I'd like to invoke here very fine Australian philosopher David Stove. And Stove said, look at what we've discovered. Look at what we know about chemistry. Look at what we know about diseases. Look at what we know about engineering. And somebody who says that all scientific theories are no doubt false is talking through their hat. And that's what I think too.
David Papineau, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And you can hear more Philosophy Bites at www.philosophybites.com.